naval fire should all be seen as equally as horrendous and as criminal and as inhumane as those men that pulled the triggers in My Lai are the ones that in my unit that pulled the trigger on those civilians.
That was Vietnam War veteran Paul Cox. Susan Schnall, former Navy nurse who was court-martialed for dropping anti-war pamphlets from a plane over U.S. military bases around San Francisco Bay. And longtime peace activist Ron Carver. All three are in Vietnam today to mark the 50th anniversary of the My Lai massacre. That does it for today's special. If you'd like to get a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Sam Alkoff, Nat Needham, Brendan Allen, and Chelsea Reel. Democracy Now! Will be in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, March 24th, for a live multi-hour broadcast from the March for Our Lives, led by student survivors of the Valentine's Day massacre at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Tune in then. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burtz, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Nat Needham, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Godars, Carl Marxer, and Ariel Boone. Happy birthday, Ariel. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for our video and audio podcasts and transcripts, and check us out on Roku and Facebook and Instagram. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us.
Abu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening of Cowboy Music and Poetry, Friday, March 16th at 7:30 p.m. at Reedwood Friends Church in Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society March Concert features the Hanson Family and Tom Swearingen. The Hanson Family plays Western Swing with yodeling mastery and blazing harmony combined with humor and audience participation. Opening will be Tom Swearingen, an Oregon horseman who tells stories of the people and land of the American West through original cowboy poetry. Again, that's the March installment of the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series presenting An Evening of Cowboy Music and Poetry, Friday, March 16th at 7:30 p.m. at Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steele Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs, Sunday, March 18th at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater in Portland. PDX Short Docs is a two-hour screening of Portland-related short documentaries produced by local independent filmmakers, including Mackenzie Blake, Outside the Frame, Sika Stanton, Donovan Smith, and more. The screening will be followed by an audience Q&A session. Again, that's the PDX Short Docs, Sunday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. Minors allowed with parent or guardian. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:03, and we are past due for the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, prosecuting attorneys tend to be white. In Oregon, they are all white.
Two Tan Republic locations have been fined $200,000 by the Bureau of Labor and Industries for wage and hour violations.
And a bipartisan bill in Congress tackles the infrastructure repair backlog at the National Park Service.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 16th, 2018. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. For every 100 1,000 white people living in Multnomah County, 1.5 are in jail. Meanwhile, for every 1,000 African Americans living in Multnomah County, 9.2 are in jail. Oh, I'm sorry, I stated that incorrectly. So for every 1,000 people living in Multnomah County, 1.5 are in jail. For every 1,000 African Americans living in Multnomah County, 9.2 are in jail. That's according to a 2016 study conducted by the Safety and Justice Challenge. The same study found that African Americans were overrepresented at every stage of the criminal justice system, from encounters with police on the street to prosecution by district attorneys in the courtroom. Efforts to draw attention to the role district attorneys play in perpetuating racism in the criminal justice system are gaining traction, and for good reason. District attorneys wield a tremendous amount of unchecked power. As Jeffrey Toobin wrote in The New Yorker, quote, "In the U.S. legal system, prosecutors may wield even more power than cops. Prosecutors decide whether to bring a case or drop charges against a defendant, charge a misdemeanor or a felony, demand a prison sentence, or accept probation," end quote. 1 year after the Safety and Justice study, another set of data was released by the Women Donors Network. They found that, as of 2014, 95% of people wielding that power were white. In Oregon, the figure is 100%.
The office of the district attorney is an elected position, but not one that has been especially interesting to voters in Multnomah County. Can you name the current district attorney? I'll give you a few seconds. One Mississippi, two, nope. His name is Rod Underhill. He is 2 years into his second term as the district attorney for Multnomah County. He ran unopposed in the last election. His predecessor, Mike Schrunk, served as district attorney for 32 years, running unopposed in all but one election. And not only is Mr. Underhill white, but so are all three of his deputy district attorneys. When the Multnomah County study was released in 2016, Underhill told the Oregonian, quote, "My office is dedicated to understanding what this study means by continuing to collaborate with the community and other agency partners and by engaging in a more robust study into the arrest and sentencing practices," end quote. But Underhill, like many DAs around the country, has run on a platform that is tough on crime. He was endorsed by then Police Chief Mike Reese. He supports the death penalty and once told the Oregonian that his most memorable cases were the ones that, quote, "stirred community outrage and touched off a collective need to see justice served," end quote. The American Civil Liberties Union has been at the forefront of efforts to raise community awareness around the power held by district attorneys. Last August, they knocked on 1,500 doors in the state of Oregon, urging voters to shy away from so-called tough-on-crime prosecutors. Underhill's current term ends in December of 2020. No word yet on who may be running against him.
Do you own a business? Now is a good time to remind employers that in Oregon, they are required to provide one 30-minute unpaid meal break to any employee working 6 or more hours. They must also provide 2 paid 10-minute rest breaks per 8-hour shift and 3 for a 10-hour shift. A local tanning franchise that owns Tan Republic stores in Gladstone and Portland either learned or was reminded of this law the hard way today. The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries announced today that they were fining the franchise over $200,000. Boley found that, during the full month of October 2016, the franchise failed to provide 365 meal breaks to 40 employees. They also failed to provide 941 rest breaks to 44 employees during that time. Boley assessed a $150 fine for each violation. Sound familiar at your workplace? Employees can contact Boley's Wage and Hour Division with complaints at www.oregon.gov/Boley/WHD. Just remember to clock out before going on your phone.
The cost of clearing the maintenance backlog for Oregon's national parklands runs to over $115 million. A new bill in Congress, co-sponsored by an Oregon representative, aims to pay for that. For more, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has the story courtesy of Oregon News Network.
Bipartisan legislation in Congress could begin to relieve the $11 billion maintenance backlog in the national park system. The National Park Restoration Act, co-sponsored by Oregon Congressman Kurt Schrader, would dedicate funding to infrastructure projects around the country. Last year in Oregon, deferred maintenance costs exceeded $115 million. That's something Jim Hammett, former superintendent for the John Day Fossil Beds National Monument, understands well. He says visitation to national parks largely is reliant on dependable infrastructure, from roads and parking lots to restrooms, which is why it's important to keep them maintained.
I certainly think that in many cases there is a limit in terms of how much increase in visitation that most of these parks can take based on just the infrastructure and the assets that are in those parks that are not being maintained or brought up to current standards.
Trips to national parks have continued to increase in recent years. They saw record attendance in 2016, topping 330 million visitors. That same year, visitors spent nearly $140 million in gateway communities to Oregon's six National Park Service sites. The legislation has also garnered support from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. The National Park Restoration Act would create a fund for priority maintenance needs using royalties from energy production on federal lands and waters. Marcia Argist with the Pew Charitable Trust's Restore America's Parks Project says a 2017 study commissioned by Pew found more than 110,000 jobs could be created or supported if the maintenance backlog was resolved, including more than 1,000 jobs in Oregon. Argist says that the local boost to economies is one reason the bill is getting support from both sides of the aisle.
They understand that parks preserve our history, and they understand that parks are important for the economics of local communities. So I think the outpouring of support from these voices is being heard.
Argist adds visitors nationwide have spent more than $18 billion and supported nearly 320,000 jobs in communities adjacent to national parks. For Cable Evening News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, I'm Sam Bowman.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. Find more stories and podcasts at nv1.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native Americans have a long tradition of decorated military service, but due to a gap in federal law, many veterans are not eligible to receive memorials of their service. As Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, lawmakers are working to change that.
A bipartisan bill passed the Senate that seeks to fix a technical problem that overlooks Native American veterans and prevents them from being able to receive a headstone from the Department of Veterans Affairs. Montana Democratic Senator John Tester is heading up the effort, and he says it's about fairness and honor.
Native Americans join the service at a higher level than any other minority. The fact is that they deserve to have the benefits of service.
Currently, families of tribal veterans can receive the gravestones if the veteran is being buried in cemeteries managed by the state or the federal government, but not the 11 cemeteries across the country managed by tribal governments. The bill that clarifies that discrepancy is now awaiting consideration in the House before it makes its way to the president's desk. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
New training aims to improve the way research is conducted in American Indian and Alaska Native communities. As Daisha Eaton reports, the curriculum is now available through the University of Washington.
The training is trying to prevent harm that academic research can cause to Indigenous people.
If you go back to the early research that's been conducted with tribes and read about how people are depicted, they're really dehumanized and devalued and stigmatized as a result. And over the years, that hasn't really changed all that much.
That's Myra Parker, assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine. She's also Mandan and Hidatsa from the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. Parker says existing training didn't take into consideration important factors such as harm or risk from the perspective of Indigenous communities and tribal sovereignty, but the new training does. There's a long track record of Indigenous people being included in research without fully informed consent. Some researches caused physical harm or emotional trauma, while other research created stigma, like the 1979 Barrow Alcohol Study.
With the Barrow Alcohol Study, basically what people came away with was that Alaska Natives you know, have a problem with alcohol, but it wasn't from a constructive perspective. It was from a stigmatizing perspective and resulted in a lot of discrimination.
Parker helped produce the curriculum with Cynthia Pearson, associate professor at the University of Washington School of Social Work, who says they consulted Indigenous community members, scholars, and non-Native allies to create the training.
Basically, what our expert panel said was, why don't we just go back to the guidelines that are governing the research and then let's interpret it from an Indigenous perspective.
Research about the new training was recently published in the peer-reviewed academic journal, Critical Public Health. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Menominee Nation of Wisconsin has filed a lawsuit against opioid manufacturers and distributors, alleging their responsibility for an opioid addiction epidemic impacting the tribal community. The complaint was filed in federal court against six companies seeking financial responsibility. The Wisconsin tribe is the latest tribe to take action against drug makers and distributors. Tribes in South Dakota and Oklahoma have filed similar lawsuits. Native leaders in Canada continue to call for a public investigation into the death of Tina Fontaine, the Indigenous teenager who went missing and was later found dead in a river in 2014. Last month, a not guilty verdict in her case sparked anger across First Nations in Canada. This week, the Manitoba government said it would not hold an official investigation into her death. The CBC reports Native leaders were quick to respond, calling for further examination. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Counterspin from the Center for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Bread and Roses with special guest Mazarine Trays of Wild Women Fundraising. And then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. In case you missed last night's weather, you get to catch it again tonight, a low of 38 degrees with a 20% chance of rain. Today in history, in 1968, American troops committed the My Lai Massacre during the Vietnam War. Upwards of 500 men, women, and children were massacred that day. And in 1995, Mississippi became the last state in the Union to ratify the 13th Amendment, which formally abolished slavery. The quote of the day is from Eleanor Roosevelt, who said, quote, "No one can make you feel inferior without your consent," end quote.
The relentless turnover in the Trump White House has caused both supporters and opponents to refer to his administration as chaotic. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
The game of musical chairs that is known as the Trump administration continued on Monday with the firing of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
As far as Rex Tillerson is concerned, I very much appreciate his commitment and his service, and I wish him well. He's a good man.
Tillerson was on a diplomatic trip through Africa when he got the sack. Insiders say that the secretary knew he was on thin ice with the president, but apparently he found out from a Trump tweet. Rex is not a man that would ever elicit much sympathy from me, but to be fired by tweet is cold, no matter how you look at it. Still, other than the fact that he'd visited ExxonMobil locations around the world, I never understood what qualified him for the job in the first place. Tillerson's been at odds with Trump since early on, so he's been ineffective as Secretary of State, and by all accounts he has done enormous damage within the State Department itself. Budgets and staff levels have been slashed, experienced diplomats have quit, morale is in the toilet, and many key embassies around the world have no U.S. ambassador. Still, he did call Trump a moron after a meeting with the boss back in October, so he gets points for that. Trump has nominated CIA Director Mike Pompeo as the next Secretary of State. Will the former Kansas congressman and Tea Party member perform any better or last any longer? Who knows? This is Trump world. Does anybody really know what's going on in there? Last week, Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer summarized it this way to CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
I've served under six administrations. I have never seen such chaos. I have never seen such infighting. And not only the rest of the world, but Americans are saying, what kind of leadership is this?
Admittedly, Schumer is a member of the opposition party, but he's not alone in his assessment. Experienced politicians on both sides have raised concerns about the near constant turnover in the White House. A March 13th article on the website for the news magazine The Week pointed out that 37 Trump-appointed staffers have been reassigned, fired, or resigned in the first 14 months of the Trump administration. Of course, that article is already 3 days old. Word now is that the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, VA Secretary David Shulkin, HUD Secretary Ben Carson, and White House Chief of Staff John Kelly may also all be on their way out. While running for president, Trump positioned himself as a great business leader, and White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said this of the president during a press briefing a couple months ago.
The president hires the very best people.
It is generally agreed that great leadership includes the ability to staff, manage, and motivate complex organizations. But despite the press secretary's reassurance, clearly this is not the case with Trump. His White House is famous for its infighting and leaks, and it has a 43% turnover rate that no successful business would find acceptable. The federal government of the United States may be the most complex organization in the world, but it is now apparent that Trump is not up to the job of being chief executive. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
And now it's time for Labor History in Two from Rick Smith and our friends at the Illinois Labor History Project.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1911. That was the day Big Bill Haywood of the Industrial Workers of the World gave his speech on the general strike. He presented it in New York City at a fundraiser for the Bucafori Defense Fund. Vincent Bucafori was a shop representative for his union. He faced repeated harassment and discharge by his foreman for executing his union duties. Finally, as witnesses described, the foreman fired Bucafori and punched him, drawing blood. Then he came at Bucafori with a heavy object. Bucafori shot and killed him in self-defense. He was charged with manslaughter, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years at Sing Sing Prison. The IWW raised money for his defense and fought for his acquittal and release. Haywood arrived at the fundraiser to deliver the keynote speech titled The General Strike. In it, he reviewed the rich history of workers' actions since the days of the Paris Commune in 1871. He also raged against electoral reform. He stated, quote, "The broadest interpretation of political power comes through the industrial organization. It gives the vote to women. It re-enfranchises the black man and places the ballot in the hands of every boy and girl employed in a shop. Makes them eligible to take part in the general strike. Makes them eligible to legislate for themselves where they are most interested in changing conditions, namely in the place where they work." He continued, quote, "You have all the industries in your hands at the present time. There is justification for political action, and that is to control the forces of the capitalists that they use against us. That is the reason that you should fully understand the power of the ballot." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us at Labor History in Two.
And now we have Radio News, a collection of stories about radio waves, radio devices, radio stations, everything radio. It's produced at WGXC in Hudson Valley, New York, a project of Wave Farm.
You're listening to This Week in Radio News, radio news about radio waves, radio art, and more. I'm Tom Rowe, your host, and we'll travel across the ether to hear what's going on in radio news.
AsianCorrespondent.com interviews Kim Hyung-soo, who defected from North Korea in 2009. He explained that radio was virtually the only way he and others in North Korea knew anything about the outside world. Quote, I was able to have access to a radio and have access to the outside world. The most popular channels are all from America, especially Radio Free Asia and Voice of America. Had I not had the radio, I would not have known anything about the outside world. So those are the two biggest things that motivated me. Radios are important, but so are other methods. With the recent technological advances in North Korea, people now have limited access to phones and laptops, so there could be USB sticks containing important information going into the country. Paper flyers are also important. People have also mentioned sending information through a satellite. There are a lot of methods, both hardware and software. We need to research which is the most effective, unquote. Ars Technica reports that the 12 lawsuits, 33 if you count each state individually, filed against the Federal Communications Commission's rollback of net neutrality have been rolled into one on March 8th. They will be heard in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which was randomly chosen, and also the court that President Donald Trump complains about the most for overturning his executive orders. Other groups can file lawsuits, and the Internet Association, a lobby group for Amazon, Google, Facebook, Netflix, and other web companies, have already announced plans to support the lawsuit against the FCC. The court does not have a timeline for a decision, but it should take more than a year. Currently, the old net neutrality rules, which prohibit Internet service providers from blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization on the web, are technically still on the book until the U.S. Office of Management and Budget approves the modified information collection requirement. IEEE Spectrum reports that on January 12th, the Indian Space Agency ISRO launched four, quote, two-way satellite communications and data relay, unquote, devices from a Silicon Valley startup called Swarm Technologies, which seem to be pirate satellites. The four satellites, Space B 1, 2, 3, and 4, are technology demonstrators for a new space-based Internet of Things communications network. They are pirate satellites because the Federal Communications Commission dismissed Swarm's application for its experimental satellites in December because of safety reasons. IEEE Spectrum says, quote, if confirmed, this would be the first ever unauthorized launch of commercial satellites, unquote. On March 7th, the FCC sent Swarm a letter revoking its authorization to launch four more satellites next month. Swarm wants to build a network that collects data from Internet of Things devices using Bluetooth, LoRa, or Wi-Fi, and then beam them into space using very high frequency radio, and then back down to users. Obviously, there are many applications for this network. The company's satellites are tiny, just 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 2.8 centimeters. But Marcus Holzinger, an aerospace professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology and expert on orbital safety, says, quote, if there's a software glitch, the satellite is going to become a passive piece of debris, unquote. Swarm and the SEC would not comment, but it appears the company has sent its four tiny satellites into space without authorization. Ars Technica reports that the Raspberry Pi Foundation has a new version of its modular computer platform with a lot of new features and the same low $35 price. The Raspberry Pi 3 Model B Plus will be even more popular for folks who make their own computer using gizmos or products. It is the same size as the earlier model, so it can be swapped in for more robust use. This year's model runs on a quad-core 64-bit Cortex A53 processor at 1.4 GHz, up from 1.2 GHz. It also has a dual-band 2.45 GHz 802.11b Wi-Fi unit and Bluetooth 4.2, up from 2.4 GHz and Bluetooth 4.1. And the Ethernet port is up from 100 megabytes per second to a gigabyte. Ars Technica guesses that with, quote, 5 GHz becoming more common in Internet of Things devices, 2.4 GHz networks will increasingly become legacy relics, unquote. TechDirt reports that when the Federal Communications Commission voted in December to roll back the net neutrality rules and allow fast and slow lanes on the Internet, they specifically barred individual states from passing their own net neutrality rules. But the FCC also rolled back the classification of Internet service providers as common carriers under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. That means the FCC ceded jurisdiction over Internet service. Barbara Van Schewick, professor of law at Stanford Law School and the director of Stanford Law School's Center for Internet and Society, has noticed that and says it means that the FCC can't stop states from passing their own rules. She writes about a California proposal to create their own net neutrality rules. Quote, the bill is on firm legal ground. While the FCC's 2017 order explicitly bans states from adopting their own net neutrality laws, that preemption is invalid. According to case law, an agency that does not have the power to regulate does not have the power to preempt. That means the FCC can only prevent the states from adopting net neutrality protections if the FCC has authority to adopt net neutrality protections itself. But by reclassifying ISPs as information services under Title I of the Communications Act and reinterpreting Section 706 of the Telecommunications Act as a mission statement rather than an independent grant of authority, the FCC has deliberately removed all of its sources of authority that would allow it to adopt net neutrality protections. The FCC's order is explicit on this point. Since the FCC's 2017 order removed the agency's authority to adopt net neutrality protections, it doesn't have authority to prevent the states from doing so either, unquote. California, Washington, and other states are all now working on passing their own net neutrality laws. I'm Tom Rowe reporting for Wavefarm's Standing Wave Radio and WGXC.
That was Radio News, a weekly roundup of stories about all things radio from WGXC Hudson Valley.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is also Sam Bowman. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Celos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomathon 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil and Celeste are joined by Susan King from CASA, the court-appointed special advocates for children who find themselves involved in the legal system. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to Claudia Rindener of Redefine Tacoma, fighting for environmental justice, clean energy, and clean jobs in a city that has a long history of doing just the opposite. At 11, it's On the Ground Radio, voices of resistance from the nation's capital. Reports on fashion.